was educated at Jawaharlal Nehru University, at the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, and at the University of Chicago. She has taught at the University of International and Public Affairs, Columbia University, in the History Department and the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and at the National Law School of India, National Law School of India University, Bangalore. Her postdoctoral fellowship was at the Center for Study of Law and Governance, JNU, and the National Memorial Museum in the library. She has been an IDRC visiting fellow at CSDS and a senior fellow with the American Institute of Indian Studies and a Kluge Fellow at the John W. Kluge Center of the Library of Congress, Washington, D.C. Her book, Righteous Republic, The Political Foundations of Modern India, has received Thomas J. Wilson Memorial Prize from Harvard University Press, the Tata First Book Award for Nonfiction, and the Crossword Award for Nonfiction in 2013. So, we would like to give her a warm welcome by. I don't want to speak. So I would like you to speak. Come here and speak. I would like to have the mic there. I don't think.
Okay, thank you so much, Krishna Swami, for that introduction. I was invited here by your fellow student Samreen, my impression was that this is a student association for the subject of political science. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I had absolutely no time this month, and I'm traveling in the near future, and Samreen was very insistent that I come. So the condition under which I came, I think, at least in my mind, was that I would treat this more or less as a class, because I believe you have a paper in Indian Political Thought, and I happen to be working on Ambedkar. So I thought I would combine the two things, and rather than prepare a formal lecture, I just want to, you know, walk you through some of these, some of the sort of main issues, I think, in all four of these ideas. The idea of Indian political thought, of, you know, what is political about certain kinds of thought, why it's thought versus other kinds of human endeavor, and then what kind of role does Ambedkar play in that. So I just want to sort of lay out a bit of an argument based on a short discussion of each of these four points, roughly. The first thing I think that you have to think about when you study this subject is, you know, what is Indian about Indian political thought? What does it mean to attach that kind of a description to certain ideas, to a certain intellectual history, to a certain field of thought which is available to us from the 19th and the 20th centuries? I'm only going to focus on modern times. I mean, the most sort of basic answer you could give, you know, what is Indian about Indian political thought, is that a lot of the important figures who are producing this kind of thought, who are producing these ideas, are Indians, right? And this includes, you know, everybody from, let's say, Bankim to Tilak to Savarkar to Gandhi to Tagore to Nehru to Ambedkar to Azad to Iqbal to even somebody like Jinnah, a whole range of people over the course of about 100 years, or maybe a little more, maybe a little less. In some sense, they all belong to this part of the world, and the issues that they are addressing have to do with the political life of this part of the world. Now, having said that, you immediately notice that their political ideas are not, in some sense, closed off from political ideas that are available in other parts of the world. Rather, a lot of Indian political thought in the late 19th and early 20th century, because at that time India is under British rule and India is actually a colony in the British Empire, and the entire educated and intellectual class, you could say, and the political leadership is highly influenced by, often educated abroad, influenced by European ideas, their encounter with British politics and with imperialism and colonialism. This strata of people who are the sort of leading political thinkers can often have a sense of politics and a sense of you know, very broad elements within politics, such as nation, such as empire, such as colony, such as rule, such as power, such as justice, and so on. These ideas often come to them from their encounter with major European traditions of political thinking in which they are immersed and in which they are located at that time, right? So immediately you see that although they are Indian, the kinds of things that they are thinking about, whether they are thinking about liberalism or they are thinking about democracy or they are thinking about communism later on in the early part of the 20th century, they are thinking about Marxism, whether they are thinking about socialism, a lot of their ideas are actually coming from outside India, right? And that is a function of their education, it's a function of their class, it's a function of the historical moment and the context in which they are located, right? And this is why, you know, the great historian, Partha Chatterjee, has described nationalist thought in India during the anti-colonial period, during the nationalist movement, as being derivative, right? In the sense that it is derived from ideas that are essentially born in the crucible of the European Enlightenment and of the rise of the idea of democracy and liberalism in the modern West, right? So it is derivative of trends in thought. Right, Indian thought at that time is very highly derivative of trends in thought which you see in places like England, like the United States, like France, and other parts of Europe. So whenever you think about Indian political thought, you have to always already qualify it, right, and understand that enfolded within that overall label of Indian, right, is a huge set of influences which are not Indian, right? There are also influences that are less known and that are not as fully presented. For example, a figure like Rabindranath Tagore goes east, right? So he travels to China, he travels to Southeast Asia, he goes to Japan, and he is in touch with what is happening in the sort of Far East. In the early 20th century, where a lot of very interesting developments are happening as far as political thought is concerned. Many of our of the political leadership in India traveled to Russia, including Nehru, including somebody like M.N. Roy, and they were both influenced by and impressed by sometimes also critical of their experience, their encounter with the communist revolutions and the kinds of huge changes that were taking place with the formation of the Soviet Union and the communist parties and the communist movements all over what was then Russia and then other parts of the world. You should remember also that in the early part of Gandhi's campaigns in India, in sort of let's say from about 1919 to about the mid 1920s, the Congress in India was also participating in, or at least giving some kind of support to, the Khilafat movement. And the Khilafat movement was a sort of movement across different parts of Asia, involving Muslim populations across a number of different countries. And the kinds of ideas that were at play in those countries and in those contexts, right, where the struggle was a very different one from the Indian national movement, as well as from other kinds of developments in the West, right, that also had an impact on what we call Indian political thought, right? So it's important to remember, first of all, the hybrid nature and the highly mixed, diverse and complex influences that feed Indian political thought in the early 20th century. Okay. Now the second kind of qualification, that we are interested in political thought, we are not interested in culture, we are not interested in religion, we are not interested at this particular moment when we are discussing this subject, right? We are mainly interested in the political. Again, this is something that you should think carefully about, right? And this is something I've tried to argue and show at length in my book. In a climate of ideas and in a context, in an intellectual context, like we see in India from about the 1880s to, let's say, about the 1940s till independence, it becomes very difficult to say that we are going to bracket out the political from issues that have to do with communities, right? Which have to do with caste, which have to do with religion, which have to do with different forms of cultural life, aesthetic practice, religious belief, social organization. All these things are linked, right? And you see that very clearly when you start to look at the thought of a number of our major figures in this period, right? For example, it's not really possible to understand people like Bankim or Tagore, or before that even Ram Mohan Roy, unless you have some idea of what the Brahmo Samaj is in Bengal, right? Or how Brahmo thinking is altering traditional forms of belief and practice in the religious life of Bengal, of pre-independence Bengal, right? Similarly, if you look at early Hindu nationalist thought, right? If you look at a figure like, and I don't mean sort of what we now understand by early Hindu nationalism, and I'll just come to that in a minute, but I mean if you look at figures like Tilak, or you look at a figure like Aurobindo, or you look at people like Malviya and so on, or Vivekananda even for that matter, right? The connection between religion and politics is absolutely unbreakable. I mean, you cannot say that, you know, we'll put aside this aspect of their thought and we'll still have a way of understanding what they're trying to say. Because for these thinkers, the only way to understand a social collectivity and questions about social justice, about the flourishing of that community, about the interests of those communities, right, is by defining identity around a vector that we today think of as being religion, right? And, you know, we may agree or we may disagree, right? And this is not just true, by the way, for Hindu reform and the social reform movements which were centered around Hindu sects, but also this is true of the kind of churning that you're seeing in the Muslim community and communities of South Asia in the late 19th and early 20th century, right? That the same people are essentially talking about their ummah, talking about their community of believers, talking about their religious group, right? And also talking about social reform and also talking about political change. And eventually trying to imagine the shape that a political community will take, right? You cannot even imagine that you would end up with the kind of nationalism that we have and the formation of these two nations of India and Pakistan without granting that religious thought plays a very important and central part in modern political thought in this part of the world, right? And we may have a critique of that, or we may respond to that in different ways, or we may be stuck with the legacy of that in different ways. But this is just something that it's important to understand. I've also argued in my book for other kinds of cultural categories and other kinds of thought playing a very important political role ultimately in the foundation of the modern political nation state in India. And I don't want to repeat those arguments, but I have sort of tried to put them out there, right? Where my basic argument is that, you know, Unless you're willing to look at somebody like Gandhi, who's highly influenced by Christianity, who's highly influenced by Jain thought, who's highly influenced by, say, the Bhagavad Gita, or you're willing to look at even somebody like Ambedkar, who later on in life decides that one way to think about defining a community is through the idea of a new Buddhism. Right, through the idea of religious conversion, and that he moves away from the idea of citizenship to a certain different way of defining community and community identity through this conversion. Right, I've tried to argue that those are very important moves that these people make, and that it's not really possible to understand the totality of their political thought, right, unless we take into account the fact that religion does play a very important part in that thought, right. And this is something about which we may be critical or we may not be, but those are separate issues. Finally, this business of it being thought, right? Now, political thought is actually, it's a very interesting category, and it's only something that we are beginning to hear about, at least in the kind of Indian context, in very recent times, I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, not even more than that. And why is that? Right, because political philosophy is something, right, and politics is something else, right, and somewhere in between these two things, we imagine lies this entity that we are calling political thought, right. Now it's very interesting that in this period, in the modern period, in India, in the Indian context. Most of the people who we could treat as thinkers, if we took them seriously, are actually not systematic thinkers. They are not philosophers. They are not in the business of thought primarily as their main, task in life. They are not sort of intellectuals in that sense. Most of them are active political leaders, right? Most of them are leading mass movements, right? Most of them are taking a role in public life, where they are building institutions, or they are leading movements, or eventually they are occupying office and so on. And somewhere along the way, they give a whole lot of speeches, they write a whole lot of letters, some of them write books, and we collect these together and we say this is the political thought of, a Gandhi or any other figure, right? So one of the interesting things about this kind of thought is that it's not systematic. It's not consistent. It's full of all kinds of contradictions because these people are actively involved in political life, right? And many times the political decisions which they make or the political circumstances in which they are placed, right, create huge contradictions in the kinds of statements that they make from time to time, right? So the same person can be made to appear to be highly, critical of caste and highly quiescent when it comes to caste. The same person can be made to look like they are promoting non-violence, and then a few years later taking part in some kind of a violent conflict, right, or justifying some kind of a violent conflict. The same person looks secular and the same person looks communal, right? So there's a certain instability in this kind of political thought, and the reason for that is that at least within the Indian context, right, we are not looking at figures who are like Marx or Mill or Adam Smith, or David Hume, right? All kinds of people who are essentially intellectuals and philosophers, right? And who make it their full-time business just to sit and write about the nature of the world and the nature of the state and the nature of the polity, right? That's not what our thinkers are doing. Our thinkers are mainly doers, right? And whatever thinking they're doing is kind of a kind of spin-off from their actual political engagement, right? So it's important to treat Indian political thought with care, because you will find inconsistencies and you will find contradictions, right? And it's possible to make the same argument, an argument about the same person and then a very different argument about the same person, and you wouldn't be wrong, right? Because people do change over time when they are actually in the field of politics, and this is something interesting that you can see developing, for example, with the Aam Aadmi Party. Right, where we don't really know, it's not very clear what their idea is, and then they're forced to put out a statement, and they put out a statement, and then something else happens, and so on and so on. This is actually the nature of politics, and this is how political thought evolves. And it's important to remember that even though we think of, you know, these people as canonical, and we think of them as the fathers and mothers of our nation, right, and the members of the Constituent Assembly and the people who actually created our nation state in some sense, they were also constantly in the fray and involved in real life politics. And this gives them a certain kind of contingency, you could say, and you have to be alert to that. And in a sense, I mean, it's most helpful if you are sympathetic to that, right? Because then if you start, posing these kind of expectations, right, that they're always going to make sense or they're always going to say the right thing, then you're not going to find that in their writing. In that sense, it's good to understand that in a political tradition of the kind that is constituted in the modern West and that we read about in when we study political science or history, right, it's a systematic tradition. It's essentially a tradition of political philosophy. Right, we don't have that kind of a tradition of political philosophy in modern times. What we have by way of political thought is thought produced by people who are both mass leaders and politicians and intellectuals. Right, and that's a very peculiar feature, I think, of the Indian case. One last thing I wanted to say about this entire moniker, right, of Indian political thought, and that is that, you know, Indian political thought, just like India itself, in some sense is a modern kind of a beast, right? But in some sense it isn't. It's also a very old thing, right? Just like India, in some sense, is totally modern and is also quite an old thing. So those elements of continuity, that those elements of carrying a historical baggage forward, right, must be taken into account, right? It's not as though before British rule in India, you know, we never had states, we never had politics, we never had rulers, right? We never had texts where people were thinking about, what is a good ruler, what is justice, what does it mean to have power, what is the relationship between the ruler and the people. These are all subjects which have been thoroughly, not only thought about, written about, but also practiced and lived for at least 2,500 years on the subcontinent. And that legacy doesn't just disappear, right? When the British enter the picture as the imperial rulers of a large part of India, right, they're entering into a context where memories of Mughal rule, of Maratha rule, of Peshwa rule, of Sikh and Rajput rule, of Vijayanagar rule, texts and traditions of political thinking are very much still present and active and known to people, right? And many of the ideas that modern Indians imbibe from the West, right, including basic ideas like egalitarianism, right, or the value of citizenship, or the importance of liberty, right, or ideas of gender equality, ideas of certain kinds of parliamentary democracy, so on and so on, ideas that become central to our republic. These are also in conversation with other and different and earlier forms of thinking politically, right, which are extant on the subcontinent, which are historically remembered, right, and which continue to inform the ordinary and popular sort of understanding of, you know, what's a good ruler, right, Raja kaun hai, Praja kaun hai, you know, what is the duty of the ruler, what issues about loyalty and power and subservience and descent. These are all widely available, and they're culturally quite distinct also in different parts of India, where there have been very different histories of rule and different kinds of politics that have held sway at different points in time, right? So when you say Indian political thought, right, be willing to understand that a kind of flat nomenclature like that actually hides within it elements that are not Indian, elements that are not political, elements that are not thought, right, and elements that are not modern, right? All of that goes into making modern Indian political thought, and you have to take it on board as such, right? And it doesn't make sense to insist on indigeneity versus, you know, derivative thought, right? That we have some sort of authentic tradition, right, which extends back to, you know, the Ayn-e Akbari, or it extends back to, you know, Ashoka's edicts, or it extends back to, you know, the Bhagavad Gita or whatever it is, right? And then say that is somehow, you know, preserved intact and unaffected by other kinds of influences which are constantly available and constantly at play, and which come to the fore and recede to different extents at different points in time, right? So historically, if you think historically, right, then the picture becomes very much more complicated. Okay, that was one part of what I wanted to say. Now I want to tell you a little bit about, it's very hot in this room, don't you think?
No, we can,
there's
no air in the room.
No, or just a window would be helpful.
Can you open this door?
Door or
can you open that door?
The second thing I wanted to obviously talk about was the place of Ambedkar in modern Indian political thought. Now I'm assuming that, you know, everybody has some sense of who Dr. B.R. Ambedkar was, right? And If you can't do it, it's fine.
Just pull open. Just a minute.
Okay, that's fine. That's totally fine. Thank you. Thanks. Now, I think in a kind of popular understanding of Ambedkar, you know, two aspects of his life and work are most important, and rightly so, right? One is that he was the leader of sort of the lowest of the low in the caste system, which during his times the community referred to as untouchables, and then now today we use the word Dalit. And Ambedkar is understood as the figure who politically empowered, who sort of politically defined, and who put into conversation with other kinds of communities this community. Right, and that is his sort of seen as his major and signal contribution to modern Indian political life. Right, the second thing which we all know from growing up here and going to school here is that he you know, was the chairman of the drafting committee of the constitution. Right, and so in short we say, you know, he's the author of the constitution. Of course, he wasn't the author of the constitution, but he did preside over the actual drafting, the creation of this text, and that makes him a very, very, very significant figure in modern Indian politics. Now, both these things are true, and I mean, there's absolutely no reason to dispute them, but what I want to put on the table is that Ambedkar actually was a very interesting and complex thinker, and wrote about and thought about a number of subjects, right, apart from issues of Dalit rights, and apart from you know, all the different questions that went into making the Indian Constitution, right? And this is the real sort of Ambedkar in a sense, because out of all our political leaders, as I was just saying, most of our thinkers are actually leaders, right? He was the most educated. Right, he was simply, many of them were educated, but he was the most educated, right? Most of them studied the law. He actually studied politics, political economy, anthropology, and the law, right? Most of them studied either in Indian universities or in England, which was the kind of practice at the time, because we were under British rule. Ambedkar was unusual in being educated in the United States and in England, right? And he was literally the first person from his community to earn, you know, a double doctorate to go to Columbia University and to study all the things that he studied. And he was also a singularly sort of scholarly person, right? In fact, you could see, if I'm currently writing A Life of Ambedkar, and you know, almost throughout his life, apart from his political activities, which are as busy as anybody else's, right, of his contemporaries and his peers, he has to continually have a legal practice because he needs the money, right? So he has to keep his practice going. And also, for many, many years of his life, on and off, he teaches, right? He teaches at Sydenham College, he teaches at Elphinstone College, he teaches in different parts of Bombay, and he even sets up new colleges, like the Siddharth College and the Milind College and so on. So he has an academic life in a formal sense, right? Which is not really true of almost the entire rest of the leadership of different persuasions in this nationalist period, right? Ambedkar also wrote a number of books which are actually scholarly books, right? They are not just, you know, published versions of his speeches, right? They are not just journal articles, which everybody was writing at the time, because so many people brought out their own journals for polemical purposes, for purposes of public debate, right? He actually wrote books about issues like minority rights, federalism, you know, the ideas of Marx, the ideas of the Buddha, you know, the history of the Shudras, the history of the untouchables, the caste system and the caste structure from an anthropological perspective. He wrote about political economy, he wrote about the history of finance and economics in India, he wrote about the rupee and whether the rupee should have a gold standard or a silver standard, which was a big debate at the time and got him into a lot of trouble with imperial authorities, which were trying to control India's economic fate by controlling Indian currency. And these are all, Ambedkar was also actively involved in the workers' movements and labor movements in sort of industrial parts of Bombay, right, throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s, right? I mean, he was not necessarily playing the leading role here, but his, you know, his participation was important for different groups of workers who were trying to talk about their rights vis-a-vis mill owners and capitalists and so on. And Ambedkar was thinking systematically about how to build alliances between a working class movement and a caste-based movement, right? In other words, he was thinking about equality very, very widely, where both class and caste played a role, right? And this is something which has completely fallen away in post-independence India, right? We see an absolute divergence between the communist and the Marxist movements in India and caste-based politics and caste-based movements, and that alliance has never been a strong one. But Ambedkar had thought about it, Ambedkar was writing about it, and Ambedkar was trying to think creatively of how different constituencies of people are disenfranchised in different ways, right? But the net result is still a very, very unequal society, right? And to build an equal society, you have to have strong solidarities between different groups of the disenfranchised, whether it's women, whether it's workers, whether it's the untouchables, whether it's other kinds of sort of groups that are left behind, right? So in that sense, another very important influence on Ambedkar, of a systematic philosopher, right, political philosopher, was the figure of John Dewey, right? John Dewey was an American thinker, a pragmatist, a liberal, an American liberal, a peculiar kind of liberal, who was actually, you know, he lived to be very old, John Dewey. So he only died in the 1950s, just about 3-4 years before Ambedkar died. But he was Ambedkar's teacher, not his supervisor, but his teacher, one of his teachers, one of the people who was on campus when Ambedkar was studying at Columbia between 1913 and 1916. And John Dewey was perhaps the single most important American liberal of the 20th century. And Ambedkar stayed in touch with him throughout his life. Ambedkar wrote letters to him. Ambedkar read all his books. And John Dewey had very interesting contributions to make on the American side to reforming American education, thinking about American schools and universities, to bringing the discussions on race campaigning against segregation, racial segregation, and for civil rights, right, in the American mainstream context. And Ambedkar was highly influenced by Dewey's pragmatism, both in terms of how he thought about education and equality through education, but also how he thought about caste as being analogous to the problem of race in the United States, right? So Ambedkar was plugged into the civil rights movement. He was plugged into movements for racial equality in the US in a way that you don't really see with many of the other Indian leaders at the time, right? I mean, Gandhi spent a lot of time in South Africa where issues of race were again to the forefront. You can't really say that Gandhi was as actively engaged with race, or that race, the problems of race helped him to think about the problem of Indian independence to quite the same extent that you can actually argue that Ambedkar, learned. He actively learned from, he looked to what was happening in the United States in all those decades. And John Dewey was kind of his conversation partner, his teacher, continued to be a kind of mentor figure for him very late into both their lives and to the end of Ambedkar's life. Finally, you can also look at particular key debates that Ambedkar engages in. And nowadays, I mean, all of us know about all these things, more or less, a little bit. We know that Ambedkar had a conflict with, a debate with, and ultimately a showdown with Gandhi, right, on the issue of who is to define untouchability, who is to critique untouchability, who is to represent the untouchables, and what is the actual solution to the problems of inequality that untouchability creates within Hindu society, right? This is something that we know Ambedkar was engaged in throughout, from let's say the mid-20s, when he first starts his satyagrahs and temple and tank entry movements, and when he makes certain alliances with what is going on in South India and the non-Brahmin movements, and with Periyar and other leaders like that, from the time of the Mahat Satyagraha in around 1927, right up to the so-called Pune Pact, right, where Ambedkar agrees to Gandhi's demand that that untouchables not be treated as a separate sort of a minority, but be represented simply as though they were part of a larger Hindu community. Right up to that time, for about 10 or 12 years, he has an ongoing conflict with Gandhi, right? And through that, you really get a good sense of Ambedkar's political thought, and you see his thoughts evolving, right? And you see him moving gradually towards a place where he begins to feel that Hindu society will always be caste society. Caste society will always be hierarchical and unequal. There's no question of reforming this. There is no question of a kind of purification of the soul. There's no question of the kind of human kindness that Gandhi talks about. Ahimsa is not the solution to the problem. The problem is to leave this kind of a community and enter into some other form of political and social identity, which eventually he does 20 years later through the conversion to Buddhism, right? He also undertakes a very long and systematic engagement with all the major religions before he chooses Buddhism as the religion of his choice for Dalits, right? He's approached by Sikhs, he's approached by Muslims, he's approached by Christians, by leadership of these communities. They all say, why don't you join us, right? We are egalitarian, right? We are not caste based, we are not hierarchical, right? We don't have the history with you that Hindu society has of discriminating against you and humiliating you. Why don't you become Muslim or Christian or Sikh, right? And at that point, he looks at all these religions carefully, he writes about all these religions carefully, and he decides for various reasons that he doesn't want to make those alliances, and ultimately it's Buddhism that he chooses, right? This is also an aspect of Ambedkar's political thought. right? Why am I saying political? Because I already explained to you that political doesn't just mean to do with politics, right? It has to do with all kinds of vectors of identity. And for Ambedkar, the rejection of Hinduism and the adoption of Buddhism are absolutely key elements of his political innovation as far as thinking about inequality and untouchability in his times, right? Those are absolutely key political innovations. So you have to think about them like that. Finally, you know, Ambedkar, I mean, if you read Constituent Assembly debates, you know, Ambedkar is often playing a kind of a procedural kind of a role, in the sense that, you know, he's supervising, he's making sure that things are written down properly, but then he makes these very important speeches at the very end, when the Constituent Assembly's work is done, just before the Republic is created in January 1950, in November, he makes these statements, right, where you can get the kind of succinct distillation of what he feels about the future, right? What he's thinking about the nature of the Republic, right? What he's worried about in terms of agitational politics and the politics of dissent, which has been the major form of political practice of the Congress under the Gandhian leadership, right? He says, okay, now the work of Satyagraha is done and we have to go into the work of nation building, right? And for that, you cannot have this kind of anarchic forms of dissent and civil disobedience. You have to enter into very different protocols of political life, right? So that's an important moment, again, in his political thought, right? And finally, you know, he's the first law minister in Nehru's first cabinet. And the major task that he tries to, and he fails to undertake there, is that he wants have a Hindu code bill passed, right, where he's talking about rationalizing rules of marriage, rules of property, rules of inheritance, women's rights, and so on within the Hindu community, which is part of his overall vision, right, of, you know, what are the different sources of inequality that enter into Hindu social life. You know, caste is a big one, right, but so are gender relations, and so are property relations and other kinds of sort of these social structures which are built into the Hindu way of life. And he wants to rationalize those. And he fails to have the Hindu code bill passed, and then he resigns his position as the first law minister, right? And he goes out of the government in that sense. So there is a large number of issues which Ambedkar has engaged with. He also writes about partition. He also writes about, how to think in terms of minorities and majorities and federation and federalism, right, in a way that nobody else is doing at the time. I mean, Congress ideology does not allow this, right? Ultimately, partition itself and the way that things work out with the Muslim League and with Pakistan also does not have a place for this kind of a vision. And a Dalit leader, Jogendranath Mandal, actually goes to Pakistan, becomes a law minister in Pakistan, and eventually has to leave because these kind of Ambedkarite ideas, right, about a nation being a federation of different minorities, all of which are more or less equally placed, on a plinth, that doesn't turn out to be the way in which either nation works. And there is a kind of majoritarianism at work on both sides. And so Ambedkar's vision there also kind of, in a sense, falls by the wayside. So I just want to say that it's important, if you're interested in Ambedkar, to widen the scope of our understanding of Ambedkar from being just the leader of the untouchables, which is a very important thing, but it's only a part of what he does. Right? Or being just the person who somehow wrote the constitution, again, hardly 2 or 3 years in this man's life, right, where he did so much else, right? And it is interesting and it is important to try to engage those different aspects of his thought, because then you really see the richness of his contribution to modern Indian political thought, and you also realize for the first time that, you know, we do have a systematic thinker on the order of which we don't have none of the other leaders are like that, right? And Ambedkar is in fact like that, and it's high time that he was recognized for his many, many different contributions. So thank you. Thank you.
You can sit and
want to shoot? Okay, who wants?
Yeah.
Who's here? So you take one by one? Like?
Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, let's. So Gaussian, you will. She wants one.
I just wanted to know your take on the statement from Ambedkar that in order to remove untouchability, we should remove Hinduism as a religion, one. Another is his statement on plebiscite, when he says that over the issue of Jammu and Kashmir, when he says we promised them plebiscite and we did not give it, and for that purpose he resigned from the job of a home minister or something.
Law minister.
Law minister.
Law minister. Okay.
Should we take some more?
As you wish, if you want all the questions at one place.
Okay, well, I mean, it's true that Ambedkar reached a point where he felt that you couldn't work within Hinduism as it existed, and you could not reform it so as to do away with extreme forms of inequality like untouchability. He did reach that point. And he, you know, since you can't do away with a community, he took the other option, which is of leaving the community with a smaller group of people and saying, this is not something that we can make our peace with, right? We don't think that there will ever come a time where Hindus will stop thinking in terms of higher and lower status, in terms of ritual superiority and others being lower, and they'd stop practicing these kinds of forms of segregation where it's still an issue to interdine or intermarry and so on. I mean, Ambedkar really believed that the key, you know, the thing that really makes the caste system work is endogamy, right, which is marriage within the community. And as long as you have endogamy, the caste system is going to perpetuate itself no matter how much political reform, no matter how much you transform the political structure, right? The core of the society remains the same because it keeps reproducing itself through endogamy. So to that extent, he did reach that point where he was completely fed up and he said, okay, this is not, you can't fix this problem. So we're going to go somewhere else. And that's what he did, right? Obviously, Gandhi didn't agree with this. Many people didn't agree with this because they felt that, it's an extreme solution, and it may not even be a solution ultimately to the real problem, which is how do you create an egalitarian polity in an unequal society, right? As far as Kashmir is concerned, I don't actually know the statement that he made on plebiscite firsthand. I can check it up, but I have no doubt that he disagreed with the main line of the Congress and Nehru on most things, right? I mean, he even had a very different understanding of partition, right? So it would not surprise me, and he always spoke for minorities. He even tried to think about untouchables as a kind of minority, which is not really different from Muslims, right? I mean, for him, the category of minority is a modular one, right? So any community vis-a-vis
a majority community, whether it's defined by caste or it's defined by religion or it's defined in some other way, right, can be thought of as a minority, right, if it appears in a certain set of relations vis-a-vis other communities and a majority community, right? But he was not successful in getting the mainstream to swallow that, right? This is the same problem as the problem of separate electorates, right? I mean, it's the same problem essentially. He was saying, if Muslims and Hindus can have separate electorates, then why can't untouchables and caste Hindus have separate electorates? It's just an analogy he's making. So if you take this to the logical conclusion, then probably it's true that he would have spoken up for many different kinds of groups which did not want to join the union, right? Which is essentially a majoritarian union. And I wouldn't be surprised if he had made this kind of a statement, but personally, I mean, I have to look it up. I haven't ever seen it myself.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. You made a statement. You said that we have to treat Indian political thought with care because there are and there will be contradictions. Mm. And we can say most of the political thinkers, so to say, they were active politicians, as you rightly said.
Yeah.
We know that at an intellectual level, we have this independent work taking place where we are trying to systemize them, though they are not systematic.
Right.
Make them coherent, though they are incoherent.
Right.
But with a, there is a parallel thing, as you rightly said, in active politics, there has been adoption of these political thinkers, and they have become holy cows. If you, for example, say something like V.D. Savarkar, then this BJP and the RSS will come. If you say something against, for example, Ambedkar, if you even try to interpret him, there will be this BSPs of the day and others.
Yeah.
And of course, Jinnah and Allama Iqbal don't have many claimers except Allama Iqbal as in Kashmir. So I'm saying how that's a challenge to modern Indian political thought, that this adoption, real time, you know the banning of books in India and all those things. So how is it a challenge to the development of Indian political thought? This adoption of the political thinkers by the political parties and then not allowing the...
India is a very hard place to do any kind of scholarly work, right? Especially history. And this is because... in a sense, ideas are not dead and closed and sitting in the ivory tower or sitting in the library, right? They are mobilized, right? And when ideas are mobilized, it can be a good thing, it can be an empowering thing, but it can also be a terrible thing when you are actually trying to, interpret, analyze, construct a narrative which is somewhat close to what might have actually happened and so on. Then it becomes very difficult when people make these kinds of claims based on, their interpretation or their idea or their memory, right? Which can be completely false and often is completely false, right? Or is completely instrumental in the sense that it's a way of using, great names, great figures, to suggest certain kinds of political power, right, without actually having a good understanding of what they said or what they did or whether that is at all meaningful or relevant in our times. This is the way that identity politics is, right? It mobilizes history, it appropriates history, it instrumentalizes history, and it makes it very difficult for somebody who's not in politics to actually enter into the game. But it also makes you realize that there's no such thing as being apolitical, even for a scholar. Even for a scholar, and that there are consequences to what you're saying, right? That people get affected by it. That people take it seriously, right? That it matters to them in terms of their self-respect, in terms of their memory, their sense of themselves in the world, right? And so you have to take that as a as a responsibility, also, right? That I'm not just writing a book and publishing it, and it's going to sit in a bunch of libraries, and it just doesn't matter, and I can just say anything that I like. That's not how politics is in India, and that's not how scholarship is in India, Actually, there was one thing I wanted to say earlier, which I forgot to say, was that the kind of Savarkarite Hindu right, which is now the
main,
which is now Hindutva, right?
Hindutva.
Actually, was the least Indian in terms of the political traditions which they relied on in their early texts, right? They were looking at fascist thought in Europe. They were looking at the Italians, right? They were looking at the Germans. They were working with ideas of territory, of blood, of race, of nationality, of nationalism, which are entirely modern Western constructs and which do not find any of those kinds of ideas in our history of political thought, right? So it's interesting that the sort of political force which claims to carry the burden of being the most indigenous and the most authentic and the most Indian and the most Hindu, right, is actually intellectually completely indebted, right, to foreign ways of thinking about society and community and polity, right? I mean, it's so far from ways in which politics was thought about or written about in or practiced in our traditions, right? That it's as far as you can get. The most derivative discourse is Hindutva discourse, right? And this is why, again, when you think about modern Indian political thought, you know, you should continually challenge your ideas of what is modern, what is non-modern, what is authentic and what is hybrid and so on. What is Indian and what is not Indian. Right. Look at who Savarkar is reading. Look at who Golwalkar is reading. Look at who they are impressed by. Right? You will not find any such thought in pre-modern India and pre-colonial India in any of the different traditions within India of thinking about rule and justice and community and so on. I wanted to say this earlier and I forgot, but you reminded me. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a very simple and small question. With regard to the 1932 Bula Pact, as you said, the so-called Bula Pact, and whereby Mr. Ambedkar was compelled to abandon the demand of separate territory. But later on, Mr. Ambedkar was very much part of the constitution making. And in that, there is a provision for SCSTs in terms of political representation.
Right.
So my question is, was Mr. Ambedkar satisfactory with this, or did he regard it as a substitute for that? What is your observation?
I don't understand.
Reservation and separate election. Finally agreeing to Gandhi's terms, accepting.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, now that I've started reading Ambedkar's life very closely, Ambedkar is constantly, I can't see you actually, yeah, you just disappeared suddenly. Ambedkar, every step of the way he has to fight a kind of Congress consensus. Okay. I mean, you know, I wrote a whole book and I didn't realize this, honestly, till I started reading the same thing, the same period, the same text, the same figures from Ambedkar's point of view. Right? So, his strategy had, even though, you know, many times he was right, and he was consistent in his demands. Both public opinion, if you read the newspapers of the time, look at the media at that time, right? They always favor Gandhi, right? Gandhi is just 50 times larger than Ambedkar is. Right, it's incomparable. Like on a public relations kind of a scale, he can never win any argument in a public forum, right? And the Congress backs up whatever it is that Gandhi is saying, right? And Gandhi is often in opposition to what Ambedkar is saying, right? So Ambedkar eventually has to negotiate step by step by step, right, through all kinds of adjustments and compromises, by going to all kinds of different fora, by writing in different forums, by traveling again and again to England, making sure that he's on all the committees, right, entering into all the negotiations. Ultimately, he is able to carve out something like a reservations policy, right? So the journey from the Pune Pact to the constitution is actually, I mean, it's only about 20 years, but it's a very long journey. It's not even 20 years, right? I mean, or a little more, whatever. It's a very long journey for Ambedkar, right? Because he is resisted, right? Any time he wants to basically safeguard the interests of the scheduled castes, the scheduled tribes, the scheduled classes, the backward classes, right? He is stymied, right? And it's not just that he is stymied by upper caste leadership, right? You must remember that there are a number of low caste leaders, untouchable leaders, and intellectuals who are also part of the Congress movement, right? I mean, the Congress Harijan leaders, right? They come from the same communities and they address the same questions that Ambedkar is trying to address, but they don't take Ambedkar's position, they take the Congress position, right? So there is a kind of schism even within the community. And it ends up being that after a while, Ambedkar is not necessarily addressing or able to have any kind of say when it comes to the non-Brahmin movements which are happening in the south, which have their own leadership, right? He is not able to have much influence outside Maharashtra. Even within Maharashtra, he's not able to have an influence outside the Mahar community, right? As far as Congress is concerned, it has effectively captured a section of the untouchable opinion and loyalty, right? And Gandhi is successful in doing that. So Ambedkar has to get what he can for untouchables in a very incremental way, in a highly negotiated way, in an atmosphere where he is continuously seen as the antagonist and the interloper, right? And even though he is more educated, even though he's right, even though he's actually making a very good argument, he doesn't get to have his way ever, right to the very end. So I think, I mean, it's really remarkable. Whatever is in the constitution by way of safeguards is his achievement, and it's a real achievement because it's in the face of so much resistance.
Ma'am,
yeah?
Ambedkar being one of the greatest leader of lowest class at that period of time, actually he has taken two actions in order to emancipate the conditions of the Dalits at that period. First of all, he has provided reservation policy under the constitution. Second, he has tried to convert a lot of Dalits into Buddhism. According to you, or according to Ambedkar, what was the best step? That if everybody would have followed, then it would have really emancipated the condition of Dalit society.
See, Ambedkar died like 2 months after this conversion. So, I mean, it's not clear what he thought about it or what would have happened had he lived, right? He also, it's interesting, he also, about reservations in the constitution, he thought that this is a temporary arrangement, right? He thought that, you know, within 10 years, and in this, he and Nehru were more or less in agreement, that basically we'll put in some provisions, and then everybody will come to kind of a level playing field, and then we won't need them anymore, right? So, in a sense, you could say that he probably imagined some kind of greater social transformation where citizenship and equality would become genuine articles of faith in the new India, right? And to the extent that that was not happening, you did need some kind of a temporary reservation scheme. And to the extent that communities were still experiencing extreme forms of humiliation, perhaps conversion could provide some kind of relief, right, for those who decided to become Buddhists, right? So, I mean, all these things are simultaneously at play, right? I mean, there is a faith that in the long run we are trying to build a democracy, we are trying to build a republic, right? There is a sense that you still need certain safeguards because it's not going to be easy to undo the work of thousands of years of inequality. And there's this additional kind of option, right, where you think about identity in a completely different way, which is as a new kind of religious community, right, which is also a strong message of rejection to caste-based Hindu society, right? I think he tried all three, and I don't know how he would have evaluated the success or failure of any of these things, you know, in the long run. I mean, it's for us to see, really.
One last question. Oh, would you like to take more?
It's fine.
Just a minute after this.
You said that there was no systematic thought in modern Indian political thought.
Very little.
In that little, would you include M.N. Roy, mm-hmm. Jayaprakash Narayan, and Ram Manohar Lohia? Because they were practitioners,
yeah,
as well as they were thinkers.
Yeah. Okay. No, I would include them, but they were also practitioners in exactly the way that most of the sort of
older figures
were.
They had this original kind of thinking,
yeah,
about
things. Yeah, definitely.
So can we say that Ambedkar thought was systematic? Because by your lecture, you said that he was influenced by John Dewey.
Yeah.
So his thought was also derivative in that sense. And what is the status of current modern Indian political thought? And if you think in terms of practitioners retreating again, back and again, to the kind of, say, political thought of 20th century or say 19th century, will you say that Aam Aadmi Party is also kind of following the derivative version of Gandhian sort of thinking? So there is derivative within derivative.
Look, I mean, I've been thinking about this, and I spoke about it earlier here in Jamia as well, that, you know, what does a term like Swaraj mean for Arvind Kejriwal? Does it really mean something? Does it not mean anything? Does it mean something very different from what Gandhi, all the things that Gandhi intended? Is it that kind of a gesture that, you know, you asked about, where it kind of helps to mobilize a whole lot of symbols and memories, but it doesn't, there's no actual content in it, you know, I'm writing a book called Swaraj, and, you know, it reminds everybody of him, Swaraj, but if you actually read the book, then the two are not alike, right? So, I mean, I would like to see greater systematicity in Aam Aadmi discourse. And I think the only person who tries to provide that is Yogendra Yadav. And he's a political scientist. So, you know, I mean, he's gone into politics, but he's essentially an intellectual, right? And you can see that in every speech he makes, right? But whether this is impacting the party or it's actually even coming out of the party and he's reflecting something which is real for his comrades, I don't know. Very little evidence of that kind.
But even he's not now systematic, because now he says Khap Panchayat, I will come later on. So he has to be also area politics.
Yeah, no, so this is what I was saying about contingency, right? That the contingency of politics necessarily undercuts the systematic nature of political thought, right? Because it's thought on the go, right? It's, you just make it up. You hadn't necessarily thought about Khap Panchayat before they suddenly presented themselves to you as a problem, right? And I mean, again, Yogenji has said that, you know, he's a Lohiite. He's written about Lohia. I mean, what this means, you know, to his party workers. We're all waiting to see, and then one can actually, I mean, it's hard to even write an article because it's so unclear what these people are saying. But as far as Ambedkar is concerned, I mean, I was only suggesting that relative to his contemporaries, because of the nature of his training and his writing and his erudition, you know, he is far more systematic. He's far more like a political philosopher than he is like a politician, right? Which still leaves him in the gray zone that I'm saying is political thought. But he is far more of that kind than any of the others. Any of the others, I would say. I mean, Maulana Azad was very, very intellectual, was very erudite, was very scholarly, right? But Nehru was not. But Nehru may have written far more than all these people put together, right? But that doesn't, you know, it doesn't, the quality of, you know, in evaluating the ideas, their systematicity, their rootedness in a history of ideas and so on. Right. I only meant in that very specialized sense that Ambedkar was more systematic as a political thinker than any of the others.
What is the current status of like modern Indian political thinking or postmodern, you can say?
I think there's a lot of interesting. I mean, it's not as if thought suddenly stops at independence. You know, but it's harder for us to be. Aware about the present, but the figures that you mentioned, Lohia and JP and you know, so many others, sort of do give you a sense that people are continuing to think about larger issues of a political nature, even outside the arena of party politics, right? And to what extent we want to take those seriously is something that, you know, is up to us. But it's definitely an ongoing project. It's an ongoing project, just like politics is an ongoing project.
So I want to ask. sorry, I'll just. From what I gathered from your talk, you're saying that our Indian thinkers seems to have taken almost all positions, like Anand says, for caste, against caste. They're not systematic thinkers. So how do we, students of Indian political thought, can we judge them in the sense, this is a better thinker than, instead of saying, this guy's a more systematic thinker and this, can we morally evaluate them in a sense? That's a problem for all Indian.
Sir, can I add to your...
Okay.
My question is also something related to it. Actually, how we can judge Indian political thinkers? Actually, day before yesterday we have exam, and I just read Sir Syed Ahmad Khan. At the same time, he was nationalist. At the same time, he seems communalist. So, can judge a Western parameter or any new parameter we want to develop to judge Indian political thinkers? And you said that the Western Marx. Actually, I think Marx and Gramsci are actively participated in politics along with their philosophical and how Indians are
communist
manifesto. Well, I think. See, I think this question of judgment is a very important question, and your example was actually quite telling, right? You were saying Sir Sayyid, you know, he was nationalist, but he was thinking as a Muslim, so he's communal in some sort of. That might be your first reaction. Oh my God, this is communal. But again, I mean, the whole point of being careful about history is that you have to place him in a context, right? You have to think, what is happening with Muslims in North India in the late 19th century? How are they dealing with what happened to Muslim power in 1857? how are they responding to the British communal awards and the partition of Bengal in 1905, right? How are they getting essentially minoritized from being the rulers to becoming, you know, more and more marginal to the national movement? What are these new imaginings, right, of communities which are highly communal in nature, which are rising for the first time in this period, right? It's not, then you think, it's not just Sir Sayyid, it's also Tagore, right? It's also, you know, it's also Aurobindo, right? It's also Tilak, right? These people are all part of a conversation, right? Where for the first time, they are beginning to conceive of communities in a modern way, where religious identity becomes a kind of divisive vector, right? And which doesn't correspond to modes of living together, which perhaps are in reality all around them at the time, right? So in that sense, immediately you want to take a step back and then say, it's not that he's communal, it's that he's thinking about a group of people who are placed in a new historical circumstance in which they have not been before, right? Where they have to talk about the limits of their community, the limits of their identity, and then enter into a set of relations with others. Right? And, you know, the Muslim League is formed in 1906 or 7, I think. 1906. And, you know, it takes all the way, it takes 40 years before we get to a point where we are talking about Pakistan. So, I would counsel that rather than thinking in terms of judgment, right? We want to make judgments in the sense that we want to make assessments. The thing to hold on to is context, right? Context, context, context. Right? You have to contextualize, you have to historicize, right? You have to not look through the problems of the present to the past, right? But look at it on its own terms so far as possible. Right? And then you will end up being less judgmental and you will actually learn more from what you see. Right? I mean, somebody like M.N. Roy, he's a leading light in the world communist movement. And he ends up completely rejecting communism and turning into a radical humanist, right? Which is some kind of a sect of his own, which nobody ever heard of before or since. Right? But obviously the man has made a journey, which is a moral journey, which is an intellectual journey, which is a journey of a political nature, right? To change his mind about what constitutes the good, right? And you can't judge that in some simple way. You can't, you know, that's why, you know, history is a tough thing to do. And unfortunately, in our country, in our public life, I mean, it's treated so, in such a cavalier way, right? And it's everybody is just rushing to make these kinds of judgments which have no meaning, they have no validity, they're just completely false, right? And they're usually made for selfish reasons. So you have to be, you know, you have to be very, very careful and critical all the time. You have to be.
I said in the very beginning of your lecture that whenever we talk of the novel ideas of like democracy and liberalism, we fundamentally relate them to as the Western ideas.
Mm-hmm.
As Partha Chatterjee talks that these are derivative political ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that there is something apart from these derivative political ideology in India, there is something originally indigenous political ideology that can be a base for a derivative political ideology for the Westerners? And don't you think that we are actually deliberately accepting a sort of intellectual slavery by just dedicating everything to the West? Because as we talk the concept of secularism, we again think of it as a West-centric idea without taking into consideration the Sufi traditions in this particular, in this part of the world. And also this idea can be traced back to the time of Akbar. And also there are some philosophers, political analysts who are making a difference between the Western society as a multicultural society and the India as a pluricultural India. What's your take on that?
I mean, I wrote a whole book about this, so I'm not going to disagree with you. That you know, there is a legacy of ideas that are not derivative, or that are derivative, or that are hybrid, let's just say, but in a very complex way, right? I mean, like I said, nobody is reading, you know, Chanakya or Edicts of Ashoka or Aine Akbari, you know, as though they dropped from the sky and you know, these are just something that we can read. I mean, most probably we are reading them in English, right? Most probably we are reading them because colonial knowledge practices even made it possible to you know, access medieval and ancient texts in a certain sense, right? So there is certainly a legacy of ideas, and I think Swaraj, for example, is the most central of those ideas, and that's what I argue in my book. But there are many others. And the way in which I think contemporary social science theorizes Indian secularism is all about the distinctiveness of Indian secularism vis-a-vis secularism in other parts of the world, right? Because Indian society is not like French society or Turkish society or American society. So Indian secularism, which is trying to find a way to live with extreme diversity, right, and structure state-society relations in the face of extreme diversity, that's what Indian secularism is, right? Because the society doesn't look like those societies, the secularism doesn't look like those secularisms, right? In addition, I think many interesting political scientists and thinkers today are trying to explore exactly what you're talking about, which is, what are pre-colonial modes, examples that we have of living together, right? What kinds of notions of tolerance are available to us? What kinds of notions of pluralism and multiple modalities of thinking about God and society and so on are available to us, right? What were people doing before secularism, which allowed them to actually live together? I think there's a lot of thinking about this.
If you consider India as a pre-conscious society, so don't you think that when we talk of it later on in later stages, for example after independence, when we talk of it as a secular country, so by just accepting that particular word, secular, by just putting that word in the constitution, how can it make this whole idea as a derivative idea? If we were really, these sort of nuances were very much there in India, but just putting that particular word into that constitution makes it derivative. How is it like that?
No, I don't think putting the word into the constitution is the problem. Anyway, the word doesn't even occur till like quite late. It comes only in the 70s, right?
70s.
After the emergency, the word comes. I don't think that the word itself is a problem, or that the fact that this is, you know, an English word is a problem. I mean, the way we think about it in Hindi is more interesting, right? Because we talk about dharma nirpekshta, right? And nirpeksh is, you know, then that gets into questions of whether it's equidistance or equal love, right, that the state has for different religions. Right? And that takes you to the question of the different model in India versus models which are available in other parts of the world. But I think, look, if you think about something like, I'm not so sure about what you mean really by Sufi thought. Let's just, we can talk about it, but since I don't know on the surface what you mean by it, let's just say very broadly that we... A major stream of thought in pre-colonial medieval India, right, has to do with certain kind of religiosity, popular religiosity, and dissent, right? And normally we refer to this as bhakti and sufi, isn't it? And this includes basically all the bhashas, It includes vernacular, poetry and literature of a huge range. It includes Hindus and Muslims and all other kinds of sects, right? And you find a certain kind of discourse, right, where power is talked about in a particular way, mortality is talked about in a particular way, life and death, good and bad, man and woman, all these things, God and, you know, sort of God and nature and soul and eternity, all these things are talked about in a particular register or in a range of registers that we broadly describe under these labels of bhakti and sufi. Inasmuch as that stream of thought constitutes a major stream of intellection of any kind, right, in the immediately pre-colonial period, right, that is going to be key to political thought in the 19th century. It is going to be, because that's what everyone knows by heart, right? Everybody knows their Bulle Shah and their Kabir and their Farid and their Jayasi and their Meera and their Surdas and their so on and so on, right? Everybody knows this stuff. Ordinary people know this stuff. Non-elites know this stuff. Non-intellectuals know this stuff, right? And that's where their sense of morality, of good and bad, of right and wrong comes from, right? So that is not derivative. That is something we take as our own, right? And that constitutes a part of our secular common sense, right? Which your professor has written about, Mukul Keshwan, right? That's secular common sense, right? So I think, I mean, this is a very long answer to your question, but I think, you know, again, I would hold off on, you know, labeling something as derivative versus authentic, because these are kind of complex questions. That's mainly what I was trying to say, I think.
Samrin will give word of thanks. Come here.
On behalf of the Subject Association of the Department of Political Science, I'd like to extend my heartfelt gratitude to Dr. Ananya Vajpayee for not just throwing light on the place of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar in Indian political thought, but also analyzing for us the Indian, the political and the thought in this Indian political thought. Now, since we've discussed about secularism here, I feel it's also the opportune time to announce that the Center for Dalit and Minority Studies, Jamia Millia Islamia, is organizing this one-day seminar on the 12th of March in the FTKCIT conference hall around the theme of the predicament of dissent and secularism in modern India. And Dr. Vajpayee will be one of the speakers in the first session. So all of you who are interested in attending that program, please let me know today. Thank you. Thank you.
वहाँ पे लंच भी वीगन सेट